Exactly a year ago this week, a video on YouTube went viral. It was called Heat Buckles Highway, SUV Goes Airborne. A road in Wisconsin buckled so badly from the heat that it sent cars flying. Well, this year the buckling continues. But if you're in certain parts of the country, you don't need me to tell you that. It's hot, and I'm not going to use that, but it's a dry heat line either. The very infrastructure of our roads is having problems with the heat, and it's not just softening the tar in the asphalt. There are less obvious effects, such as droopy power lines, buckling highways, as I mentioned, and railroad tracks even, and less efficient airplane takeoffs. These are all among the problems that may spoil your day. Joining me now to talk about the heat and how cities are adapting the infrastructures for warmer temperatures is Vicky Arroyo. She's Executive Director of the Georgetown Climate Center, part of the Georgetown University Law Center in Washington. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hi, Ira. Thanks for having me.
You didn't happen to see that video of the SUV going airborne, did you?
No, I think I missed that one, but there was a lot going on. I mean, I certainly heard about the plane stuck in the tarmac here in that National Airport last summer around the same time.
I just saw today, as I was researching this on the internet, highways out west are buckling now from the heat that's going on out there.
That's true. And out west, they did last year. Of course, you know, heat is the number one expected impact from climate change that you'd expect, and it affects infrastructure as well as people.
Mm-hmm. And here in the East, where we heavily use railroads and commuter railroads, they're actually finding trouble from the heat, too.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, rails, you know, buckle or kink as they warm, and you see some slow tracking of trains. So your metro or your subway commute might
right.
be slower in an era of climate change. And people are trying to get a handle on what this means for how tracks are constructed. For example, the elevated rail lines in Chicago are vulnerable. They don't have the concrete base. So obviously, if something goes wrong with that elevated track, you'd be in trouble.
You know, I was looking at the Virginia Railway Express Company, which supplies commuter trains right there to your area from northern Virginia to downtown D.C. And on their website, they say that an 1,800-foot length of rail will expand almost 1 foot with an 80-degree change in temperature. Wow. That's amazing.
Yeah, and, you know, the thing to keep in mind is that this infrastructure is built for the past conditions in a local area. So it's not to say that we can't change our infrastructure with climate change in mind, whether it be climate change impacts along the coast like storm surge or sea level rise. But it's obviously going to take time and it's going to take money.
Mm-hmm. Our number is, there you go, two magic words. 1-800-989-8255 is our number if you'd like to talk about the infrastructure. Maybe something's going on in your neighborhood that is becoming the new normal now as the temperatures go over 100 degrees out west and as our climate is changing. You can also tweet us at SciFry at SCIFRI and send us a note on our website at sciencefriday.com. Now, you know, of course, we always hear that the electrical utilities have their hands full during the hot days, but I assume they have plans, right, for increased demand on those days.
Well, they have plans for increased demand, but one of the local heads of a utility said that we're having a 1-in-100-year storm every year now, it seems. Of course, we had the derecho last summer. We had Superstorm Sandy just north of us here in the D.C. area, obviously hitting New York and Connecticut and New Jersey.
Yeah.
And power companies like Entergy in my home state of Louisiana are taking on some changes, whether it be operational changes like trimming trees around power lines or using shorter, stubbier poles, if you will, to hold the sagging power lines that you talked about and make them stronger for wind. They're even actually taking the unusual step of trying to restore some of the wetlands that can serve as a buffer to storm surge.
Wow.
So people are really dealing with it. In Washington, D.C., where the Climate Center is, D.C. government is spending $1 billion to bury the power lines.
Wow, that's a great solution. Hang around with us.
Sure.
We're going to come back and talk lots more about the infrastructure, what the new normal is with heat and different climates. So stay with us. We'll be right back after this break. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're talking this hour about how increasing temperatures affect infrastructure from transportation to electrical generation. My guest is Vicky Arroyo. She's Executive Director of the Georgetown Climate Center. If you'd like to talk about how the heat is affecting your town, we'd like to hear from you. Our number is 1-800-989-8255. Maybe you have some unique problems in your town where the heat is forcing you folks to do something different. You can also tweet us at SciFry, SciFri. Vicki, you were talking about before the break about how people are actually going to be burying power lines. That's refreshing.
In Washington, D.C., yeah. I mean, and of course, there are some places that you can't necessarily do that because the water table is too high, and then you've got the risk of flooding if you're along the coast. And, you know, half of our population is in coastal counties, so it's not a solution for every place, but certain governments like D.C. are taking steps to do that now.
You know, we were thinking about, you know, because we had Hurricane Sandy here. We had loss of power for many days. A lot of people are thinking about installing backup generators.
Well, that's right. Yeah, and of course, the irony is that backup generators, if they're powered by diesel, a fossil fuel, they're really ultimately contributing to this climate change that we're experiencing. And as you saw in New York, it's not necessarily a panacea, depending on where those generators are located.
Yeah.
So recently, Mayor Bloomberg and others in New York actually put out a report recommending some changes to the New York building codes, including just basic things like making sure that windows open so that when there's a power outage, people can still find the building that they live in habitable. Water access, if the water pumps are not working to get the water to the higher floors, but water access in common areas down lower in the building. And also making sure that places like hospitals elevate their backup power generators, because otherwise they don't really do you any good.
Yeah, we were in a southern city that's, you know, subject to hurricane flooding. I think it was Savannah. I was walking through Savannah, and I walked by a firehouse, and they had their generator two stories above the floor.
Mm-hmm. Makes a lot of sense.
Yeah. 1-800-989-8255 is a number. Let's go to Jim in St. George, Utah. Hi, Jim.
Hi. Thank you. Love your show.
Is it hot enough for you?
Oh, absolutely. In St. George and the surrounding area, I'm about an hour and a half north of Las Vegas. Over the years, you know, initially about 100 years ago, temperatures ranged in the low 100s in the summertime. Well, as of lately, with the types of materials that we use in buildings and stuff like that, the temperature is getting a lot hot. You know, we're working at 121 degrees in Las Vegas sometimes, and in St. George, it's usually, you know, 115, 116 degrees. Problems, you know, arise when we use these materials that are extremely reflective, that hold the heat in, and it's never allowed to be released, and so throughout the day it just continues to get hotter and hotter. You know, we have problems with asphalt where cars in the parking lots get stuck because the asphalt melts, or you step in it and it makes a mess of your shoes. I think we really need to concentrate on, especially in these cities, trying to figure out materials that are, you know,
Don't hold. Well, he's gone. I think he just melted.
I hope not.
Well, he's right about that. Don't we have these urban heat islands, right?
Well, yeah, we absolutely do. And, of course, climate change and global warming is going to just make that worse. And so there are things that along the lines of what he was talking about. You can try to have cooler, more reflective roofs. You can paint them white, for example. That will both decrease the temperature for the occupants in the building so that they can stay longer during a heat wave, but also bring the temperature of the surrounding area down and save energy at the same time. Same thing with vegetated green roofs. The D.C. government is actually helping to defray the cost of new green roofs with home and building owners by sharing the cost of installing those green roofs, and they're doing that through a fee on plastic bags. The reason being that those green roofs also capture some of the rainwater so that it's not, you know, washing off in storm water runoff, which as it rains, it pours, is another impact of climate change that we're trying to avoid the worst consequences of. So.
Let's go to Sarah in Eastern Long Island. Hi, Sarah. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hello. We have a lot of problems out here as we've been affected by very high tides. And our local officials are really not doing anything. They're allowing oceanfront homeowners to put up enormous bulkheads and steel plates to keep back the ocean, which is not going to work, in violation of the New York State DC regulations. And our beaches are washing away in front of them, and people can't pass. All of a sudden, the beaches are going to be just unusable. And this is a summer resort, and the engine of our economy is our beaches. Our local utilities are not burying cables, and it's just we have a lot of floodwaters coming off fields with runoffs into our ponds and clouding them up and causing tremendous algae blooms, and it's as if they're deer in the headlights. They don't know what to do.
Are you out there in the Hamptons?
Yes, we are.
Yeah. Any suggestions, Vicki?
Well, this is something we actually work on quite a bit at the Climate Center, and one of the things that we're finding is that when communities are trying to do novel things, like Maryland, for example, where they're trying to not go that route of putting up seawalls everywhere because it actually does just exacerbate the problem, plus it's eliminating the places where fish hatch and natural beaches and wetlands. But it's a longer process. You know, we were really set up for another era, and the Army Corps and the state permitting often allowed those seawalls to go up pretty easily through the permitting process, whereas an exception to that kind of hard armoring actually takes sometimes years. So you can see why people are rushing to try to defend their property in ways that really might be counterproductive and certainly not great for ecosystem health or also for storm surge in the long term. So one of the things that we work on is trying to change those policies with the future in mind, because it is going to look different from what we've seen in the past.
Good luck to you, Sarah.
Thank you.
Thanks for calling. So how do you get cities to prepare?
Well, you know, they're starting to really do this more and more on their own. If you heard President Obama speak at Georgetown last week on climate change, he talked about the importance of working with state and local communities because they're already on the front line. So some of them have been up to this for some time now. You know, Chicago, because of its heat wave in 1995 that killed so many people, New York City post-Superstorm Sandy, a lot of them have already started to take measures. Mm-hmm. Like the changes in building codes that I mentioned, cooler roofs, stormwater capture to reduce some of the surface flooding. Even my hometown of New Orleans is trying to use some of the vacant lots that are still there post-Katrina to sort of contour them so that the water stays in place, not from a dramatic incident like Katrina, which obviously caused, you know, severe flooding,
right,
but from the more routine storms that actually cause a lot of flooding. Anyway, I mean, Hurricane Isaac last year, that for most people is an afterthought, was a billion-dollar storm in that part of the world. And, you know, part of it was from just the rain. I mean, you know, 18 or 20 inches of rain in some spots.
Mm-hmm.
So if we can find ways to live with the water, to have more green space, to capture the water, that's better for everybody.
Let me see if I can get one more call in from Brian in Ventura, California. Hi, Brian.
How you doing?
Hey there.
Yeah, hey, just wanted to mention, I'm an energy engineer, I work for the Navy, and one of the things we're looking at is doing more distributed type power using natural gas, maybe through fuel cells. You can also build renewables into that mix, and it kind of gets away from, large power plants and high voltage, inefficient high voltage transmission lines.
Interesting. Engineers.
Under gas thoughts.
Yeah, engineer more local power stations.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up because it brings to mind two things. One is that smart grid, which we often think about for distributed generation and renewable power to come online, can also be an important solution when it comes to some of these extreme weather events, because you can actually cut off the part of the system that's down and you can reroute power, especially to the places like hospitals or schools that you need to get them up right away. You need to get the energy up right away. And we also saw after Superstorm Sandy that some of the clean fuel vehicles, the natural gas trucks in Long Island, for example, were able to remove debris when everybody recalls there were those long lines for weeks at a time for regular gasoline and diesel. So alternative energy can actually be part of the solution to a more resilient economy as well.
But it takes a lot of planning, right? You have to think about it and plan for it.
It does.
Get everybody together.
And everybody together.
It's like herding cats sometimes, though.
Well, and at every level, at every level of government and in your own home. I mean, how many of us have provisions if we have an extreme storm event that puts our power out for a few days to be able to, you know, have the food and the water that we need, to be able to have a backup if, you know, we're only on cell phones and those go down? How do we communicate with people? I mean, people really do need to make plans for this at every level of government and in our society.
Mm. Well, we'll stay in touch, Vicki, okay?
Thanks, Ira.
Thank you. Vicki Arroyo, she's Executive Director of the Georgetown Climate Center, and we're going to have a lot of climate this summer, so I'm sure we'll be retouching with her.